It's really hard to believe that we were... Isn't this where we launched? We went on a kayak.
I keep forgetting you've been here before. Yes, and it's sort of a right down on the shores of the river, and it's a leaden grey sky as far as the white horizon. Goodness, it's brisk and cold and miserable, shall I say, or is that my overstating it? It's just it's hard to be cheered by the landscape, but it's wild. Wild.
But so what I remember about that day is I think we launched on the riverbank. Just here, because we're looking at this wide tidal river. I think we launched on the riverbank here, and we went around the sort of marshy headland and out towards the sea.
Yeah, it was really time critical with the tide when you came, and we had to get here on the on a rising tide. So we launched off the slipway here, the muddy, slippery slipway, and then worked our way actually downstream, but against the incoming tide. But to get to this creek where we were aiming for, which is only passable on the highest of tides amongst the glasswort, the salicornia and the many birds, that was that we went up that muddy creek, do you remember?
And it took us so long to get there that in order to be able to get back on the next tide, we camped overnight under the stars.
It's hard to imagine being so warm, wasn't it? I'd taken lots of layers, but it was t-shirt weather paddling there. And then overnight, we actually didn't even need a tent of any sort, did we? We just were able to lay on a couple of blankets and just lay under the stars and enjoy the silence.
Yeah. Let's go indoors.
It's cold. Act One, Scene One, Peter Grimes, Benjamin Britten's famous opera. A high tide coming will eat the land, a tide no breakwaters can withstand.
I'm Colin Williams.
I'm Ian Rowlands.
And this is Beneath the Stream, a podcast about the human experience in the non-human world. Where are we, Ian?
We're in the Sailing Club Hut. That's where we are. We're in a little cabin right down on the shores of the River Auld. The wind is gusting fierce outside, and the skies are grey, and we're on the North Sea in the depths of winter.
Yeah, it's lovely to hear those maritime sounds, the wind in the masts and the rope and the mast ropes, and there's lots of maritime clanging going on all across the boatyard and onto the river. And as you say, we're looking out to this river, this wide tidal river. The oyster catcher are calling as they pass, and it's a nice scene, but it's cold today.
Yeah, and it's part of the appeal, isn't it? I always remember that Benjamin Britten, the composer, famous for being an opera, was living in California, but was eager to return to the cold North Sea shores of Suffolk. And I love them too, truthfully. You know, and it's deserted today. There's no soul in their right mind is wanting to be out on the water. And it's just us and a microphone and a table and huddled looking out on the water.
So the reason we're down here is that we wanted to talk about tide, and the tide, and it's on the face of it, it's not a big subject, but actually there's the sort of human relationship with the tide, and therefore with the nature of the tide, is obviously long and deep and complex. Mysterious, just like the tides themselves to a certain extent, and all of those things all of those everyday phrases which we use, ebb and flow and time and tide wait for no man, they're part of our life now when we talk about the tide.
Yeah, and I you know, I'm a person with a powerful belief in our, you know, the enrichment that nature can bring us, and I think this connection with the non-human is so strong. We're drawn to the sea, we're drawn to water. It's one of the most common human instincts. And as many people are battling to sort of save our shores, the notion of the tide taking things away but bringing things in is a really powerful one, I think, at this time in human history.
So it is cold here, but I want to take you away from here, Ian. I want to take you to the summer just gone, the summer of 2023, and I was with a friend, and we were in the warm and leafy surroundings of the Anglo-Saxon church at Corhampton in Hampshire.
I don't know.
And if you go to that, if you go to that place, just to the right of the porch is a sundial carved into the wall of the church. Nothing unusual about that. There's thousands of sundials in our churches here in the UK. But this sundial is unusual because instead of being divided into 12 hours, it's divided. It's a tide dial, and is divided into 8 tides, approximately 3 hours long. And those tides are either for secular or ecclesiastical use, allowing workers or holy men, monks, to know which tide they were in. And some of those things survive in our language today when we think of eventide or yuletide. But within the day, there were 8 tides. And that speaks of the etymology of the word tide, which just comes from time. And so when we talk about the sea tides, they're just the times of the sea, I suppose, the way that the sea and the planet marks time.
Hmm. I kind of like the temporal nature of that. I'd never heard of that before. That's new to me. And I am fascinated how we humans, we like to regiment and subdivide things in categories. And that's the strict time and tide when things happen. Whereas the natural world, I guess, is responding to natural rhythms, but we're responding ourselves, but organising ourselves in a nice way.
Yeah. So I thought what we'd do is we'd start at high tide, and we'll follow the progress of the tide down to low tide, and talk about all the things that brings us and that means in between times. How does that sound?
Sounds great to me. And I'm high tide is a magical time, and it's felt I'm always drawn to when's the tide at its highest, and it has such an impact on. On the things that we can do and see.
So let's start high tide. Now, I've, like all these things, I tend to ignore the prosaic reality of how these things occur and how they come to be in favour of the poetic. So tell me, tides. How? Why?
So we have the influence of the moon on the planet, and in certain places the tides are more extreme than others. The water pulled by the gravitational pull of the moon is a very glib description of that. And I've been to places where there have been extreme tidal regimes, like the Bay of Fundy in Canada, where the rise and fall is the greatest tidal difference anywhere on the planet. Here it's fairly marked on the eastern shores of England. In the Mediterranean, not much at all.
Barely anything.
So certain places respond to it more than others. Mm. And I'm always interested in the way that changes during the year. And you get these very particularly high equinoxial tides in spring.
Spring and neap tides,
Indeed, yeah. So, I mark them. I must admit, I do notice them. I mean, there's two things that pop up on my Google Calendar, and one will be the phases of the moon. And the other will be the heights of the tides. And maybe not everybody's drawn that way, but if you use the ocean, you'll be absolutely dictated to by those things.
Yeah. I've always been a bit curious, because I've never taken enough notice, really, but about what the sort of turnaround time is. So the moment something hits high tide, it's at its highest point. Is it typically a long time before it's actually starting to imperceptibly go out again, or is it almost instant?
I can only give, and sure, that will vary, I'm quite sure, depending on where anybody's listening and their familiarity with their local water. I can tell you here, when being out on the water of the river here, that moment between the height of the highest of the tide and then it beginning to ebb and flow away is precise, it's quick, it's fast. You have a moment when you... it's not so visible on the shore, I don't think. It looks high and the water is lapping on the highest part of the embankment or the beach or wherever. Here it's the sort of the slipway of the boathouse. But in the water you notice it straight away, because there is a twist in the current. And 1 minute you're facing one direction, and then imperceptibly over the course of little less than 30 minutes... you're turned around and facing the other way. The boats around you, all moored up, are all pointing into the incoming tide. You can tell where the water's coming from. Mm. And then they begin to rotate on an axis
and all together like a flock of starlings all point a different direction, the same direction, but the opposite direction to the one they were before.
Oh, that's beautiful. And the other things that high tide bring to mind is that for those of us that are sort of bird watchers, and especially in places where the receding tides expose mud banks and mud flats, often birders are very keen to know when the high tide mm-hmm. is, because the high tide pushes, it kind of reduces the amount of mud that is out there and pushes the birds closer into shore for better observation.
Yeah, so you'll see them closer, and then they will also have to find somewhere to go. And it's one of the great dilemmas of the modern age, is that we don't leave much space for nature in our lives anymore, literally as well as mentally. So those birds all pushed up on the high tide have to find somewhere to sit it out.
So high tide also, so when the tide is flowing, when the tide is coming in, our human history really is riven with waiting for the tide, waiting for the tides to be right. You know, there's all sorts of, certainly in, we might come back to a traditional song later, but certainly in English folk song, there's got a lot of mention of tide, and often tides are associated with departure in folk song. And there's quite a few references to waiting for the tide, or somebody is leaving, and they either have to rush to catch the tide, or they will be departing with the tide, a sort of certain inevitability of this departure and this leaving.
And they don't wait. Time and tide wait for no one. And I love that thought, that the natural cycles, the natural processes that we sometimes forget about unless we're connected to it, they don't wait. They have their own rhythm, and we have to fit with their rhythm, which I really, really like. I wondered, actually, because I find high tide fascinating because of the things it casts up. Sometimes the things that you find, that those, you know, we're here on the shore, and you can see the weed and the grass and the branches and the leaves that have been cast up by particularly high tides, that detritus of the land which has been deposited here. And I wondered whether you've got any thoughts on other things that you found at high tide, because I've got one or two, but you go first.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. I've recently been working in Denmark a lot, and on the sort of Wadensee coast on Denmark, the high tide lines of the great sort of west-facing beaches, those extraordinary high tides, as we talked about in the equinoctial tides, deposit these huge strand lines of things. And just walking along that strand line, I took a chance a couple of years ago to walk along one of those Danish strand lines just for a couple of miles, and all human life is delivered to us by the tide. Wigs, light bulbs, bottles, the bones of animals, the bones of birds, the sort of desiccated skulls of different seabirds. I came across great big slabs of fat.
Really?
That are sort of ejected from kitchens, and they're there as well. I came across a mermaid costume and different bits of wood, especially worked wood, sort of pallet wood, that because of their markings, you can identify where they're from. And so you get all these pallets that are from landlocked countries from around the globe. But because of our sort of maritime commerce here on the planet, that they get moved from these landlocked countries out to sea, get lost at sea, fall off boats or, you know, fall off docksides, and get washed up by these tides. And so there's all kinds of fishing gear, all sorts of things. And you imagine that, I often imagine that if you then lived on a cabin on the beach, you could burn a stove in a cabin on the beach forever with the things that the tide delivers to you. Perhaps feed yourself as well.
You've clearly been dwelling on that, Colin. This is the last resort, is it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So in my experience, tides deposit all human life along the strand.
That's lovely, and it's a real, I'd forgotten, because I spent some time up in Svalbard, Spitsbergen, up in, not far from the North Pole, and the beaches there are strewn with things that have come from all over the world that these tides carry and are cast up at high tide. And there's famously a story of a cargo of these little yellow bath ducks, you know, little floating ducks that literally was tipped off the boat by accident in a storm. And people were able to track where they went, and these little yellow ducks ended up on beaches from the Arctic to the Antarctic, following the tides of of our oceans. Yeah. So.
And lobster pot tags
are another thing
that you see in certain places quite a lot.
I like that concept because it goes back to that sort of etymology, the origin of the word tidings. You know, what tidings have you? And what news is there? What reports? And so I have found at high tide messages in bottles.
Oh, really?
Yes, twice. Wow. Twice I found one. One didn't come very far away. It was just about 100 miles from further up the coast, which was interesting. I didn't get a reply. I'm not dwelling on that, but I did reply to the message. But I also found another one which had come from the Netherlands here. So it's my favourite story of this, actually. I'd forgotten this one. I once found a... They used to have these balloon races where people would launch a balloon with a tag on and whoever's got furthest and was reported back would win. Glad to say that thing's much less of a thing now. But I found on a beach in East Anglia, Norfolk actually, a balloon tag from Belgium.
Right.
So I replied to this. This is a long time ago, so I was like in my... I'm an old man now, so I was in my 20s, and replied to this and sent it back. I didn't get any message back, but it was like a competition. Years and years later, about 2 years ago, I would say to be precise, I was at a meeting of scientists looking at climate change, and I recounted this story, and across the table, the man's face fell in shock, and he had been the winner of that balloon race.
No, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And so we assume, anyway, the tag was returned from somewhere in Eastern England and he had won. And lots of the chances of us two as individuals meeting.
It's extraordinary, and
that was that he remembered the date of the race and it kind of coincided with when I found the tag. And I love that sort of, the tide brought us together.
Yeah, wow, amazing. Amazing story.
I would also like to chip in here, because we're near Orford, just a little bit further down the coast, is that... the tide there mythically tossed up a wild man, the wild man of Orford, who couldn't speak English, was covered in hair, and seemed to live a marine existence, and was caught on the high tide in fishing nets, and was taken to the castle, Orford Castle, the tower there, and imprisoned, but eventually released.
Sometimes the only time you get to hold and touch these creatures is when... their bodies, their remains, are left by the tide.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of, even now, all sorts of, you know, social media sea monsters still appear, even though in most cases they're just decomposed whales or giant squid or whatever it might be. But people are still finding sea monsters or wanting to find sea monsters left by the tide, which I love.
Yeah.
I love that our imagination still makes monsters out of the ocean.
We have a desire for that, don't we?
Yeah.
And still, you know, and I think there's that sort of... child in me still. Mm. I mean, we were on the Mediterranean recently and I saw all these sea gooseberries, you know, the little little comb jellies, as they are. And of course, your mind is playing with that. These creatures from the deep that you wouldn't normally encounter are suddenly cast up by the tide and lying there on the shore, lifeless, and you ponder their existence.
Yeah, we thrill to those little tidal occurrences, these little chance meetings with something we wouldn't otherwise come into contact with.
You were talking to me about in Denmark about the speed of tides and the way they race across the sand. And so tell me more about that.
Yeah, so when tides are flowing, especially in the Wadden Sea, the Wadden Sea is Earth's largest contiguous intertidal system of mudflats,
mud
and sandflats. It's a very important habitat for the planet's birds and wildlife. The tide appears as if from below. It's not a thing that would be noticeable in the same way as on a sloping beach where you can see the tide sort of getting closer and closer. The tide in places like that tends to grow from below. And I remember the in the biography of the great artist Peter Scott, he had the same reflection. He often said there that the tide grows like snow. And so just like when it's snowing and you look out the window and you think, oh, it's just started to snow, and then you sort of look away and you go back and suddenly the ground is covered, and then you look away for a few more seconds and it's covered a bit more. It never happens while you're watching it, but it's the imperceptible growth. The tides are very much the same there. They seem to come from under the mud itself and grow, but it happens very, because of the flat uniform nature of it, happens very quickly. All sorts of, just like, you know, if you've been to places like Lindisfarne, Holy Island, there are sometimes causeways across to the Wadden Sea Islands, and there's lots and lots of dire warnings about not getting caught by the incoming tide. Mm. You know, lots of photographs of submerged cars and people sitting on top of their cars needing to be rescued.
It is one of the terrifying prospects. Yeah, nowadays it scares me.
So the speed and rapidity of those tides can be quite frightening, but also quite beautiful. And actually, and as you say, all those little rhythmic changes that brings, changes in the behaviours of the birds, changes in the sort of colour and texture of the environment, the way the wind brings different tastes when the tide is coming in than when it's going out. Very subtly but noticeably affects the world around us when the tides are on the move.
How lovely. That's beautifully described.
So high tide, and then at some point the tide has to ebb.
And I'm looking out of the window here, and we, by coincidence, are at that moment. The tide is retreating from us. There's more mud and clumps of weed exposed. In fact, I can see lots of little birds arriving, turnstones here, and Dunlin and Redshank coming in as the mud is exposed. And the boats are beginning to turn. Can you see?
You can see the movement on the water because there's a bit of texture on the surface.
The little Loch Long sailing boats out there are just turning. Deceptive here, because the tender that takes people out to their boats is still facing the other way, but that's the current swirl around at this bend in the river. So it's not uniform. In fact, when you're paddling here, you need to pick your spot, or you're constantly battling against the current, even when you think you're with the current. But yeah, the tide is dropping now.
Mm. I want to return to a bit of folk song if I can. There's one of the great English folk songs, and it's been recorded by the big names, you know, fantastic artists, John Bowden, Eliza Carthy, Shirley Collins, Peggy Seeger, Peter Bellamy, Tony Rose, Robin and Barry Dransfield, the list goes on and on. And it's a song called Just As the Tide Was Flowing. It was collected by Vaughan Williams, and a couple of famous recordings from very close places you'll know well. Harry Cox of Potter Heigham and Sam Lana of Winterton-on-Sea, both in Norfolk, not very far from each other, both recorded sort of versions of Just As the Tide Was Flowing. It's great. And without going too much into the story, which is broadly woman meets sailor, amorous connection, but satisfying for both. The tide in that song, because Just As the Tide Was Flowing is the refrain, each verse of the story closes with the words, just as the tide was flowing.
One morning in the month of June, down by a rolling river, there a jolly sailor chanced to stray. There he beheld some lover. Her cheeks were red, her eyes were brown, her hair in ringlets hanging down, her lovely brow without a frown, just as the tide was flowing.
In that context, the tide is backdrop. It places an extraordinary act, the meeting of these two people, in the context of something ordinary and inevitable. And my interpretation of it, and other more expert people might have quite a different interpretation, is that human life and nature is as inevitable and as rhythmic and as predictable as the tides. And people are always going to fall in love, people are always going to fall out of love, and these things happen in this song in the backdrop of the tide, which, you know, in this cycle of the tides, and so it's as sure as the tides are going to come in and out, just as the tide was flowing, humans are going to be humans.
That's nice, I like it. It's not a tidal reference, but it's a there'll always be lovers as long as the gorse is in bloom.
That's right, yes, yeah. So, yes, that's what my mum used to say. Her version was as long as the gorse is in bloom, kissing is in fashion.
Oh, that's right, yes, yes, that's the way I remember it.
Being weary, both sat down beneath the trees with the branches round, and what they said will never be known. Just as the tide was flowing.
I like the idea as well, that the tide flowing, the rhythm of that, but the ebb and what it takes away. So it's carrying away things from us, which I find really fascinating. And I wondered whether there are things you have lost to the sea, that the tide has taken away. Is there anything that's sort of dropped overboard or dropped on a beach somewhere and you went to find it and it was gone? Because I've got one or two, but I thought I'd ask you first.
Probably not so much a possession, but I often make the mistake. The wonderful thing about the tide, and especially the places that the tide covers and uncovers, are that they're constantly... Those things are also constantly in motion. And so there have been times where I've sort of been walking along a beach maybe and seen something on the strand line or just on the edge of the water. And you think, oh, that's something catches your eye, whether it's a shell, a stone, something man-made that is unexpected. And a few times I've made the error of going, oh, well, I'll pick that up on my way back. And of course, even if you can remember the spot relatively precisely, the tide has probably already moved it.
Yeah.
And it would have gone, turned it over, taken it away, shifted it another foot or two along the beach. And so the places that the tide touches, the tide is a paintbrush in many ways. The places that the tide touches are in constant motion. They're constantly moving. Remember to pick up that stone, pick up that shell, pick up that thing that the tide has left, because it won't be there. The tide will move it, and because the tide has a miraculous and remarkable ability to sift and sort things in itself, it means that the lines that it deposits on beaches as it ebbs or as it flows in and ebbs away are different every day, different with every tide.
Isn't that exciting? I mean, you did a wonderful description of it, and I love that impermanence in a way. That's what what makes us get out of bed every morning, isn't it? There's something new to be discovered, I suppose. And I like that very much. Funnily enough, I once dropped my car keys on a beautiful stony beach, a rocky beach on the island of Iona on the west coast of Scotland. And I had people with me, and I didn't realise I'd dropped the keys until we got back to the car. Now, by some miraculous for planning, which is unusual for me, there were a spare set hidden somewhere on the vehicle, so we were able to drive away. But the next week I was due to go back to the same beach, and absolutely with no expectation of finding anything, walked the shoreline, and there were no keys where I knew I'd dropped them. I'd been scrambling around on the rocks, but at the other end of the beach there were my keys.
No, wow.
Yes. So the tide, I guess because they're metal, they hadn't really lifted quite so far, but the tide had moved them from one side in the turquoise waters of the beautiful white sandy beach to the other side. And I love that notion of things in motion, I suppose, that things are turned up.
So as tide ebbs and in different parts of the world, it's going to reveal different things. What are your thoughts on that? The way suddenly it changes, and
in our ways, I suppose, because of where we are, it's very hard for me to get out of a sense of local geography here, and about it taking things away and exposing something new is very much a visceral part of life. I was drawn to think of Dunwich, the famous sort of medieval port, some ways maybe 10 miles up the coast from where we're sat now, which is no longer there, taken away. But they said for some period after, well, there was a great storm. I think it's the Dunwich, the medieval town that is mentioned in the Domesday Book, so it's very ancient references to it. And then there was a big shingle spit there that allowed a natural harbour entrance to build up. But gradually the tides changed that and exposed a different landscape. And then there was a great storm in 1286, something like that. I think it's well documented. And for some time afterwards, on the low tide, there were churches and buildings still exposed by the withdrawing tide. So in a way,
wow,
you know, that must have been, that's a powerful thing to still see your town there, but once every 8 hours or whatever, you know, every, depending on the regime of the tide. And there's something about that sort of time, rhythm and things. But yes, I've not been to many places where I've seen changes in the strata, but I have been to places where places have been eroded away.
And this idea of an ebbing tide exposing our former history.
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite the notion, isn't it? Isn't there a place on the North Norfolk coast, a Neolithic...
Yes.
A sort of wood henge type,
exactly,
of monument,
yeah,
that's exposed at low tides.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, you know, we have that, you're edging towards talking about Doggerland in a way, aren't you? You know, the whole, for those not familiar with, the whole notion that, you know, Britain was not just connected to Europe, but firmly part of it, you know, the Shetland Islands to the north, way to the north of us here, were hills on a shoreline landscape of a land, and gradually it began to separate, and there was this mighty tsunami which inundated the land, so buried beneath the sea away to our left here, out to the east, is land, you know, mammoths, communities, people were there.
Well, just to pick up on that a little bit, the next thing I wanted to mention really is that a receding tide, whether it's exposing these muds or these sand flats, these intertidal ranges, also gives us the best chance we're ever going to have, really, of walking along a seabed. And there's something that was ocean some hours before is now land, or an amphibious version of land. And so the ebbing tide exposing these places does give us this chance to walk on a seabed, which is a lovely notion, I think, and I have the bounty that leaves. I have a very happy childhood memories of walking out on the sand and mud flats of Norfolk with my grandparents, with a rake and a bucket.
Oh, really?
Raking for cockles, because it was my
shellfish.
My granddad's favourite thing to go rake these cockles. There are family photographs of us just sitting on deck chairs in this completely empty mud flat landscape. But, you know, with great big grins on our faces, having a lovely time raking for cockles. And then in the evening, not that I was then a big cockle fan, in the evening they would cook up these cockles with and eat them with brown bread and vinegar. So these ebbing tides expose these new landscapes. And I suspect, like you, I've been... taken the chance to effectively walk out to sea once these things, and just walk, you know, almost 2 miles straight out to sea in these great big flat intertidal places, and where you become suddenly the highest point in the world. And it's that wideness and that space that attracts people, and it attracts all sorts of people, horse riders, you know, sort of sailboarders, walkers and lovers and families, and they're all down there on the beach enjoying the wide open space, because I guess for a lot of people beaches are kind of nature in its most raw form. The very fact that the sand is created from a ground down matter from our planet and from our oceans means that it's kind of it's nature's most basic form, and so people go there and shed their clothes and shed their shoes so they can run and shout and leap and dance and do all those things which you can't do in the confined vertical world of our homes. They go out onto these wide beaches in order to just release themselves, and lots of families do, whether it's just dog walking or walking or hunting for treasure down on the strand line, whatever that might be. Yeah, all life gathers at the water's edge once the water exposes this wide open playground.
That's lovely. I had this vision I hadn't really thought of before, of the sort of coming and going of the tide, and we're watching the birds at the other side of the glass here sort of arriving on the mud, and then you have this human population that comes and goes, and the tide will wipe them off that sort of exposed ocean, back to their lands, back to their homes, and then it exposes it again, and everybody gathers again for playtime or food. Because I think of those habitats as really quite threatening and unsuitable for humans in lots of ways, you know, exposed, precarious existence. But I know from a bushcraft point of view, from a survival point of view, the shoreline is one of the most productive places to be. There will always be food of something that always something you can eat. Much harder to find food necessarily in, you know, the moorlands, the heathlands. There's more in the forest if you know what you're looking for. But the shoreline is a place, particularly, you know, a lot of Aboriginals, Indigenous people, you know, whether it's the Pacific Northwest of Canada in the USA, or, you know, the Northern Cape in Australia. Yeah, there are people that's where they make their living, is what the sea provides, and it's so much richer an environment to be in.
And these tidal marshes and these tidal flats are hugely important habitats for the planet's wildlife, and we are doing our best to absolutely destroy them. Our rising tides are removing those ancient intertidal ranges that are so important, as discussed. And from a landward side, we're doing our best to push back those ranges, whether through drainage, through development, through developing our coasts for energy projects or whatever it might be. These things are really important, not only to feeding the life that we're looking at now, but also as things that capture the planet's carbon, hugely important for holding back climate change.
Yeah, and I've been to a number of conferences. I've been, you know, closely involved in ocean-related things for a number of years in conservation myself, and the coastal forums, the coastal development projects. These are areas of conflict and contention and change, because it's the area that humans most want to play with, from a recreation point of view, from sea defences and preserving what we had, to those who want to preserve the wildlife and the landscapes that are there. So yeah, the coastal strips for most human populations are the place of acute sensitivity, really, and they change everything about life. I mean, right here, there are all sorts of ways that people are thinking of dealing with the inevitable changes that are confronting this coast, the climate change and the higher tides and the change in sea level that the rising temperatures are bringing. So here it's what bits do we let go? What bits will we let the tide carry away? What bits will we try and protect from the processes of ocean and wind? And here is an area which is at the forefront of that. Are we going to keep hold of it? Are we going to let it go? And then what happens to all the other creatures that depend on these places in a time of profound change? I mean, out here there's seals, there's harbour porpoise, jellyfish, lots of fish, the birds that we're talking about, and more. And this will be played out everywhere around the planet. So it's impossible really to talk about tide without the profound changes that are happening to the tides. The unpredictability of things.
Just as the tide comes and begins to go again, we're at a turning point as to whether we choose to protect these places or let them go. And I want to, in part, finish with a quote from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and it is Brutus speaking to Cassius on the eve of war, saying that you have a chance to grab something now. He uses the tide as a metaphor. And he says, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. We should have had Kenneth Branagh read these.
Yes. Work on
Why didn't we get Kenny?
Work on it.